Hello, and welcome to the Practitioner Scholar, the Penn CLO podcast. In this podcast, we journey through the intersection of academic rigor and real-world impact, spotlighting the practitioner scholars who are shaping the future of organizational learning and leadership. Whether you're an aspiring leader, a seasoned executive, or simply intrigued by the transformative power of education and research, this is the place for you. So sit back and prepare to unlock new perspectives as we delve into the compelling stories and insights that will define the future of learning and leadership.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the Practitioner Scholar, a Penn Chief Learning Officer podcast. I'm Melissa Monti, and I will be your host. So far, we've showcased several alumni with impressive personal and professional achievements from the Penn CLO program. Just to refresh, the program is an executive doctoral degree path through the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. The curriculum, which hones into five core focus areas, prepares practitioners to become organizational learning and development thought leaders within the private and public sectors. I'm also a current student of this program. In this edition, we will highlight an alumna who not only graduated from the Penn CLO program in 2010, but is also a Penn CLO faculty member, serving as the academic director of what we call the Business Block. That's a semester dedicated to a 360-degree overview of the corporate sector, from best practices in finance and marketing to creating value with human resource partners. Dr. Ann Schulte also currently serves as Senior Vice President of Talent Development and Chief Learning Officer at Procter & Gamble. She has global responsibility to support all learning and leadership development and to drive comprehensive strategy to transform the enterprise into a dynamic, skills-based organization. Her scope includes enterprise learning, organizational capability, leader and manager development, executive development, team effectiveness, and coaching. She also embedded growth mindset at P&G, building an empowered, agile, and accountable organization to win with consumers and operate at the speed of the market. Just prior to P&G, she also served as the Chief Learning Officer at MasterCard Worldwide, where she established an award-winning corporate university. Today, we'll learn a bit more about Dr. Schulte's best practices. Also, though, as many are aware, artificial intelligence has recently dominated news headlines, leaving some wondering how it will affect them at work. For that reason, Dr. Schulte will share insights on AI and its impact on current and future corporate learning initiatives. On that note, please welcome Dr. Schulte to our program. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, I'm delighted to be here, Melissa. Thank you.
Thank you again. This episode focuses on several topics, including how Procter & Gamble is leveraging AI to revolutionize talent development. We'll also find out how the always beta mindset fosters continuous workplace innovation, and we'll explore tips on remaining a lifelong learner. But first, Dr. Schulte, I'd love to learn a little bit more about how you transitioned into your current role today. I understand you actually hail from a more of a non-traditional background. You started in journalism, advertising, and also public relations. Could you share more details and whether there are parallels that you see from those fields to learning and development?
Of course. As you said, I earned my bachelor's of journalism from the University of Missouri, the oldest J school in the nation. And soon after I started working, I enrolled in night school in Kansas City and got my master's in media. I used those two degrees, doing advertising and public relations work, for a national retail jewelry chain called Helzberg Diamonds. I saw lots of malls in my early career. But my journey into L&D started with a different kind of small step, and that is from crafting externally oriented communications to internal communications or employee communications. I was seen as the resident writer. And so I was soon being asked to do employee newsletters and training documentation in addition to the advertising and PR work. And then when I had my children, I resigned and started my own business, still focused on writing. But now my scope got much wider because I would write anything that people would pay me to write. So I wrote a corporate history book, I wrote functional accounting manuals, I wrote signage for the Kansas City Zoo in both the Africa and the Australian exhibits. I wrote several corporate annual reports. And each of these, when I thought about it, could be described as learning tools. So I began to see that using words and experiences to build skills and influence human behavior was a baseline that applied across many business activity systems. Just as advertising influences consumers and their choices, employees are consumers of work. So how you communicate, train, and influence employees form the basis of the employee value equation that seriously impacts business outcomes. In fact, I did my UPenn dissertation on the relationship between learning and development and employer brand practices, but that's another story.
Yeah, very interesting. I would love to hear about that one day. As you highlighted, you had to develop new skills for a new discipline later in life. The same applies for workplace learning, of course, in many cases. Through your endeavors at the helm of L&D, what are a few core components you've found that have helped others really retain training and apply it to the workplace?
I use a very simple model called Know, Do, Be. It's a continuum that helps others understand the key to learning and applying new skills in the workplace. We have all experienced business leaders who come to us and say, we need a training. Do we really? That's our business, is to decide whether a training is the answer to a performance problem that a leader is having. I guide with questions like this. I ask people, what is it that users or learners or employees, what do they need to know? And if they need to know something, there's a lot of ways to inform. You can read, you can listen, you can watch. But if we're talking about something that people need to know how to do, that's different. Just reading, listening, or watching is not going to be sufficient. We must show people steps to take, and most importantly, we must give them opportunity to practice, preferably in a non-operational environment, so they feel safe to make mistakes and try again. If we want people to be something, that's still another step on the continuum. If I want you to be a great manager, or I want you to be some sort of expert, then we need to design experiences that give you multiple opportunities to perform and get feedback in different contexts. So for B, we need to add the construct of time. You do not become an expert on anything in a training classroom.
Very good. In your experience, do companies give employees adequate time to be something?
To be something, yes. Where we often have the gap is in the do something. We tell people how to do it, and we don't give them any opportunity to practice, and we expect them to just go out and do something different. If you go do something different and you don't achieve success, you slide right back to your old behaviors. So without practice, there's no true guarantee of application. And without application, the time you've spent in a training program is just simply like manufacturing scrap on the floor. It's waste.
Good advice. Thank you. I'd love to jump right into the topic of AI, something that a lot of folks feel anything from excited to outright skeptical about these days. At a high level, how do you view AI personally? Is it a friend or a foe?
I have to be honest, it scares me because all humans, change can be threatening. But I also believe that change can be as good as a rest. So I try to approach change and challenge with an open mind, what Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset. With smart strategies and hard work, I believe that I and my team and all of those who are in the future of work can learn about AI, can learn to use it. I might not be the best expert, but I do believe I can get better.
What's your philosophy on AI and the unknown, specifically around maybe secure and ethical data practices?
This is really important and something we pay attention to. I think we have to be aware and discuss the possibilities and the consequences. I was reading a report recently. I think it was a Deloitte report just came out, and the author stated, "What we do now determines next." And I thought that profound. Think about how the internet changed everything. Now, you're going to have to go back with me 20 some odd years or what have you. But I do recall working before the internet. I do recall only certain people had access to the internet. And I know that what has happened over time is it has changed everything. It's changed how we work. It changed how we play. It changed how we spend time with our friends and family, how we stay connected, how we love, how we fall in love, all sorts of things. Everything's different. And it's been wonderful in many ways, but it's also brought us things like cyberbullying and increases in mental health challenges and troll factories. So the point is, and what they were saying in this Deloitte article, is that we don't know how a technology will be misused until people really start using it at critical mass. So from a learning standpoint, we can also look and say that using the internet and using search engines has freed up our mental resources for problem solving and creative thinking. I don't have to remember addresses or directions or phone numbers anymore, and I can use those cognitive resources for more important things. But at the same time, using search engines to retrieve information has also been associated with increased distractibility and ability to pay attention. So the generative AI tools that we have today go a lot farther than the simple search engines that we've been used to using. And so we have to assume that as they not just locate information for us, but evaluate it and synthesize it and give it back to us in some way, we are going to need to think about whether the outsourcing of this part of our cognition, the outsourcing of our thinking, is going to change the way we learn again. And I think clearly it will. So we need the combination of human-led quality control. We've all heard about the errors of generative AI, of hallucination, they call it, and the embarrassing moments for professionals, lawyers, et cetera, who have taken information at face value without checking. I like what Ethan Mollick is his name, and he's at Wharton. I like to read his writing and follow him, and he has said something that really resonated with me. He said that generative AI is like an overeager intern who sometimes lies to you. If you keep that frame in mind, you will not forget to check and keep the, what are the biases? What are the assumptions? It's really an opportunity as leaders or teachers to increase critical thinking. So it's not so much about generative AI is doing the work for you and you're cheating. It's generative AI is doing a different part of the work. And what are you going to do and how are you going to increase your critical thinking skills to evaluate whether the information that's being presented to you is credible and credentialed in a way that you are okay using it?
Good advice. And I love that analogy. Also, in speaking with you, it sounds as though P&G has already taken steps to experiment with AI use cases. One of those steps is to apply AI towards skills assessment. Can you tell us how this is paving a path toward a more inclusive experience?
Yeah, so most people in our industry, in the learning and talent development industry, are familiar with the movement toward being a skill-based organization. And one way that a skills-first organization creates a more equitable experience for employees is by changing the requirements. Rather than using an educational degree as a shortcut to determine who is qualified to do what work, we can look for evidence of skill development and application. So if you can program in Kubernetes, why should I care where or how you learned it? In a world where talent is scarce, I can't afford to dictate how you learn a skill. Show me that you can do it and get me first to market, and I'm good. But the approach changes all sorts of embedded talent practices in recruiting and attraction and retention and development that we have relied on to retain good talent. All these embedded talent practices and shortcuts don't work for us when we take out the requirement that you must have a college degree or some other such thing. So in an AI-fueled environment, the objective shifts from evaluation and labeling to discovery and matching. And that's a really hard thing for employees and leaders to do because we have such a long history of looking for those labels, looking for where did you get the degree? Who said you were rated a one? Who said your proficiency was advanced? Someone must verify. I can't just trust you to do it. What we also know and have learned in the skill-based journey is that we started with thinking about skills as binary. Most of the systems that came out with skill clouds or taxonomies did not have associated proficiency levels. They just said a skill is something you have or you don't. Yes, I have it. No, I don't. If I'm trying to staff an outcome-based team and I'm looking for people with the skill of driving, and you got your license yesterday and someone else has been driving NASCAR, to see driving on both your profiles is not very helpful for me. So we are in this conundrum where we need to know the level of experience that people have, but we can't burden the organization with asking managers to evaluate every employee on 20 to 30 different skills at 4 or 5 levels of proficiency. It just collapses under its own weight. So what we can do, and we've been experimenting with generative AI, is using it to help employees self-assess their proficiency. And it works this way. If you start with a definition of a skill, let's say a skill is anything you can do, and I want to understand what you can do instead of just what you know, then you can craft a prompt for the generative AI engine to ask me questions that help determine how much I have actually used or applied the skill. So I might start with something that says to the AI engine, you will generate 5 questions assessing my proficiency level on developing others. You will ask me these questions one by one. The questions will be designed to assess me based on my specific experience and on what I have already done more than what I know. And then you will prompt me with each of these questions on the assessment until you get enough information to give me a score based on 1 to 10. I will add to this prompt, I will add other things like give me short feedback, give me a maximum of 100 words, here's the scale that I'd like you to use. But in addition, this is helpful because it gives us time to build trust. When we started our skill journey, I told leaders, we will use a body of evidence to determine someone's proficiency. We will use AI to say they've had this many jobs where they've used this skill, and they have this many certificates or badges that prove that they have applied it. And we will use this kind of inference. People don't, they're not ready to trust that. They want to know someone who says, I know Melissa, and Melissa has done this well. And so we're caught in this kind of middle ground where we have the capability to use AI to infer people's skills, but the habits of the people we are working with are not ready to trust it. So we have to go little by little, and giving employees the ability to self-assess through a tool like this, a generative AI, instead of just saying, boy, I think I'm expert. Having the tool help us evaluate, again, without burdening the managers, is something we think is going to be valued and important. But we're still just testing it.
And specifically, how is generative AI changing the learning game at P&G?
Oh, there's so many things that we can do with it. And just finding time to experiment in new ways is our first challenge. But one of the things, if you can just suggest to people how they can use generative AI, and we have our own internal ChatGPT, one that's private to our organization, so we can give people access. And I think we have a dual role as learning leaders. Not only do we have to help the business with their strategy for generative AI and how we can use it to change the way we work and really save time and be more productive, but then we also have opportunities to use it as learning leaders ourselves to do the work that we are responsible for doing. For example, generative AI tools can be great research partners to help analyze a business problem or model potential solutions. They can generate content outlines, refine ideas, propose different instructional strategies or virtual reality experiences. There was a test or a pilot that BCG did with generative AI where they asked a development team, to put together a training course, and they gave it 6 weeks and a certain amount of money. They found that they could do the development in much less time with many fewer people. They had maybe like a team, I'm making this up now, I don't remember the exacts, but maybe instead of a team of 5, they were able to do it with a team of 3. And instead of in 6 weeks, they got it done in a couple of days. But they found that that too improved, that there was a learning curve to using generative AI. And their first attempt through, they saved some time, but by the time they moved up the learning curve and the end of the experiment, they were producing things in hours that used to take weeks. So it can really speed up development and be a huge help for us on design, but it can also help with the more transactional, mundane things like localization or translation. We used to have to do things so far in advance so that we could send things out to be translated into all the different languages that might be needed for our plant populations, our manufacturing populations, et cetera. So this is almost instantaneous. And just with a quick check, it's a huge help for us. Generative AI can also provide real-time guidance and support to learners. It can be a coach. Just like it can help assess your skill, it can coach you. It can help you revise your writing. It can help you understand things, and you can give particular persona prompts. Explain this to me as if I were a third grader. And then you get that back. The generative AI has the capability to do that. We just have to know enough about how to use it to ask it to do things for us in ways that will help. It can also help with automating nudges, translating, etc. So generative AI can contribute to evaluating learning outcomes by providing automated assessments like we've talked about, interpreting learner responses, providing instant feedback and scoring and tracking, also learner attitudes and engagement. It can also help automate L&D nudges that translate employee development plans into workflow prompts. And who knows what else? We're just experimenting right now and barely getting started.
Very good. Much like your own blended professional background, team compositions are no longer really siloed like they used to be within just marketing or just HR or just finance. Practitioners really need to be able to work across multiple disciplines. So how is AI solving for that?
It helps me to think of AI not as magic, but as the next round of automation. So the digital revolution and automation has changed very much about how we work. My favorite example of functional work blending is thinking about e-commerce or digital commerce. If you are working on a brand that is being sold online, is that a marketing job or is that a sales job? It's actually a bit of both. With skill-based views, some logistics and IT built in. AI helps us suggest training course content for certain skills that can quickly cross-train different functions and provide personalized learning journeys. So that's where I think it helps us the most.
And it sounds as though the always beta mindset is a phrase you've coined to ensure teams are always experimenting with cutting-edge innovations, such as AI. Can you share more on that?
I will certainly share that I did not coin the term always beta. I think maybe that was Google. I have adopted it as a mantra with my team. So we are in the manufacturing business, and the come from state in the industrial age was standardization and scale. Drive all variability out of the system. But again, the digital revolution has changed this. We can't wait for perfection or the opportunity passes us by. So if my team takes 8 months to create a training program, whatever need assumptions we have made are likely to have shifted and will be wrong. We're working in a world where technical skills have a shelf life of under 2 years, or half-life, they call it. And what that means is that in 2 years, half of the skills that you use to do your job will be obsolete. So we have to work faster. We can't get everything buttoned up and right. We have to go in with something that might help and then iterate and adjust. And that's better than, I think it's Facebook that says done is better than perfect. We have to get in there and help to build the skills and then be willing to shift when something doesn't work.
How are you and your team staying mindful of equity inclusion while leveraging algorithms associated with AI?
This is really important to us, and we're paying attention, but it's not a simple thing. AI can introduce bias, but so can humans. When I was talking about the skill assessment, part of the reason why we like to use AI for skill assessment is managers don't always know. And so they take a stab, they take a guess, and that's biased. AI can be written in an equitable way, but used unfairly. AI can also help mitigate bias. But this goes back to this combined requirement for human controls on the technology. We want to use the power of the AI, but have augmented with human quality and usage rules.
As we've mentioned, you're also a Penn CLO faculty member. How important is it to ensure emerging learning leaders are properly armed and prepared with these insights in order to empower their own audiences?
I think it's really important because, as I've heard some L&D people rejecting AI in the name of human-centeredness or belonging, they want to be human. I don't buy that. We are seeing a fear of uncertainty that they don't want to admit. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Generative AI is here. The future of work is here. It's not next. It's now. So I actually asked, when I was talking about my own team and talking to my team about how we were going to use AI, I asked ChatGPT for a title of this new era of learning, and I like what it gave me. It said, strap on your learning boots. I'm not sure where that came from, but strap on your learning boots. And that's my advice. And the same thing with whether you're learning to use AI or whether you're learning to be a learning leader. I'm a teacher at heart. I can't get away from it. It's in my blood. It's the way I contribute. And it's why I've stayed involved in the Penn CLO program. But we have to work with the future. We have to magnify the best and focus on what's next. So there's a lot that we know that stays the same about humans and how they behave. But we also know that the methods that we use and how we've shifted from the agrarian to the industrial to the digital is changing the way people engage with information, and that is changing the way they learn. And if we purport to be experts and scholar practitioners, we have to study how that's working and how that's changing.
You certainly have the practitioner experience, but have you explored moving into more of the academic writing and publishing space to help other aspiring L&D professionals maybe build best practices?
That's my next chapter, dear. That's my next chapter. Again, that's why I'm staying involved, and I've moved from just teaching in the program to being the academic director of the business block. There is room for additional contributions to the field. And not only in the corporate world. I think there's lots about our educational practices, K-12 all the way through to adult learning, that need to be revisited. And it's up to us to do that work.
On topic, you had also mentioned a funny experience with a writing assignment as a Penn CLO student. As you had mentioned, you have a background in journalism. So in theory, you're supposed to remain objective and report the facts. How did you find that contradicted with academic writing?
Oh my goodness, that was so funny. As I said, I had an equity. My equity was I'm a good writer. I take pride in that. And I wrote my first paper at Penn, which I worked really hard on. And it came back with some comments. And one of them was that I had submitted a well-written summary. Duh, right? I'm a good writer. But that the evaluator would like to see more of me in the writing. Would like to see more of my thoughts, my opinion on what the other scholars had said. And I was aghast. I couldn't even compute it. I was like, I had spent, at this point, when I went back to the Penn program, I'd been in the workforce for more than 20 years. And I'd spent all that time taking myself out of the writing, making sure I was being objective, making sure that I was reporting just the facts without letting my opinion sway. And so it was really jarring, and it was difficult for me to do. It took a lot of practice. I had to work and write and rewrite and sometimes submit several versions of the paper until I satisfied the evaluator. But it was growth. And growth is uncomfortable, and that's how you know you're stretching and know you're growing. And I finally learned that, yes, my voice contributing to the field is of value. And I learned how to use it. But yeah, it was funny. You think you're good until you're not.
Until you're checked. It's right. Definitely a challenge. So I can definitely back that up. Well, you graduated from the Penn CLO program roughly 14 years ago. How has the program grown and changed since then, in your opinion?
Quite honestly, the student body is much more diverse in terms of backgrounds. When I was in the program, it was largely corporate CLOs or wannabe CLOs with a couple of CEOs or CHRO types thrown in. In the last 8 years that I've been teaching, I've been intrigued and actually gratified to see a wide range of professionals commit to understanding how workplace learning and leadership can be used to create value. The discussions are very rich. The network is so interesting. We have teachers, we have salespeople, we have coaches, we have nonprofits. I mean, it's, and yet they all have this understanding that influencing how we learn and lead is a path to value.
And how has the Penn CLO program specifically impacted your career, even as a faculty member, if it applies?
Yeah, I would have to say credentialing. Quite honestly, learning and development leaders had no, you could be an IO psychologist and people know what you do, or you could be some other kind of PhD. L&D people came from all different walks of life. There was no major when I got out of school in learning and development or in talent development. You came from other areas of the business because you happened to have an issue or a passion. So when the Penn CLO program came out as the first executive level doctorate for work-based learning leaders, it was a really important credentialing that helped me attract. I became more attractive to other companies. It attracted a like-minded network of professionals, and these people have become lifelong friends. The 14 years since I've been in the program, there's a couple of my classmates that I correspond with on a daily basis, daily. And others that I see twice a year, and some we still connect on what's going on in our industry. So it's been very helpful.
I can also agree with that as well, too. I happen to have a lovely cohort, so I think the format is great. Okay, what are a few things you hope to see in the future of learning and development thought leadership?
I'm interested to see how AI is going to integrate into our understanding of cognition and change how we teach and learn and lead.
In your opinion, what's the best part of seeing others acquire new skills or maybe work toward their own educational goals?
I like the confidence that I see. When someone nails it, when they get it, when they do it. My grandson was here this weekend and he was throwing a ball into a bag. And every time he got it, yes, he's two. Yes. But it's the confidence that comes to the individual who has acquired a new skill that is really lights a fire for me and why I like to continue teaching.
You mentioned being a grandmother just there. How are you hoping they view their own educational journey?
I want them to love learning, of course. As I said, I worry about our educational system in the U.S. I think it's broken in many ways. So that could be an area of contribution for me to think about as the next chapter also. If my children have that growth mindset and my grandchildren have growth mindset and love to learn and stay curious, I think they'll be okay.
On that note, personally, what is your favorite tool or method to learn something new? For example, I'm really getting into interactive learning with augmented reality. How about you?
Not so much. Just be honest. I'm a visual learner. Okay. I like to read. I like to look at diagrams before I try hands-on practice. Practice, as I said before, is absolutely essential. I am not good with just audio, and I am not good with just immersing myself into a reality and figuring it out. I want to know what I want to try first and then go try it. But that's my learning pattern. Other people are different. All my children are different. I've got a couple kids who are total audio learners. I never understood. I tried to make them take notes and make them map their notes and use different colors and didn't work because that's not the way they learned. And I am well aware that there's a lot of critical thoughts about different learning styles, but I'm not trying to type them. I'm just saying that I know what helps me learn best. And that is to take information in, be able to process it, and then go try it. And that works better for me than putting me into a sink or swim situation that is immersive because I don't like to make mistakes.
Understandable. All right. And final question. What's the best way to position ourselves inside or outside of the classroom to ensure continuous learning?
All right. With this, I have to go with the mantra of the growth mindset, which we have in many corporations adopted, but it came from research done on fourth graders. Carol Dweck at Stanford did this and saw what it was that kept kids trying versus having them stop, not having the confidence to go on. There's a cheat for it that I use, or a little hack that I talk to people about. And that is, instead of focusing on looking good, so like I said, I don't like to make mistakes, but if I switch my focus from, am I going to look good, to can I get better? So from looking good to getting better, then I end up looking good at the end, because I force myself to see change and challenge as an opportunity rather than a threat. I can get curious and stay curious and say, what is it? What am I seeing? What am I learning? Why is it different than what I thought? And if I keep asking those questions, that's it.
I think that message is so important, particularly for the younger generations right now, fixated on being perfect. Instead, let's just think about how we can get better. Dr. Schulte, thank you again for joining us. This has been such an informative session. For those who would like to contact you or maybe follow some of your great work, what is the best way for them to do this?
Hit me up on LinkedIn.
Dr. Schulte, thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that brings us to the end of another enriching episode of The Practitioner Scholar, the Penn CLO podcast. We hope you found inspiration in the stories and insights shared today. These narratives serve as a testament to the transformative impact that well-informed leadership can have across organizations and industries. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and stay engaged as we continue to explore the ever-evolving landscape of leadership and learning. Thank you, and goodbye until next time.